have to like a lot of things, like school. But I'm sure you've made the right choice. She helped Brian on with his jacket and watched him walk to the carpool ride outside. Not 10 minutes later, Jean had received a call from her husband, Jerry, who had driven to work early. "Honey," he said, "I just found out I have a meeting after work. The last time I showed up late for dinner, there wasn't any. Think you could save some this time?" Jean laughed. "Last time, you never called me to let me know. I really appreciate your telling me in advance. I'll feed the kids, and you and I'll eat together later." "My son makes it to school, even with a cranky attitude. My husband calls me to inform me about schedule changes. I'm dreaming, aren't I, Lord?" Jean wasn't dreaming. She was, for the first time in her life, experiencing the rewards of setting and maintaining clear boundaries in her life. A great deal of hard work and risk-taking had gone into them, but it was worth it. She rose up from the table and began to ready herself for work. Jean saw visible, demonstrable proof that her boundary work was bearing fruit in her life. Things were different. But how did she get from point A, boundarylessness, to point B, mature boundaries? Can we measure our boundary development? Yes. Specific, orderly changes herald the emerging of mature boundaries. It's helpful to be aware of them. The following 11 steps allow you to measure your growth, to see where you are in your development. Use this chapter as a guide to the next step in your growth. Step number 1, resentment, or early warning signal. Randy had never before felt irritated at his best friend Will's sarcastic digs. Resentment was a new sensation for him. Being the butt of the jokes had always been easy for him. Good-natured Randy could roll with the punches. But when Will came up to him at church and said in front of several observers, "Are you buying smaller clothes or putting on weight?" Randy didn't laugh it off. He said nothing to his friend, but the remark stuck inside him. He was embarrassed and hurt. He couldn't shake it off as he had for so many years. "This never got to me before," Randy thought to himself. "Why is it getting to me this time? Maybe I'm getting too sensitive." One of the first signs that you're beginning to develop boundaries is a sense of resentment, frustration, or anger at the subtle and not-so-subtle violations in your life. Just as radar signals the approach of a foreign missile, your anger can alert you to boundary violations in your life. Randy had come from a family who largely avoided conflict and disagreement. Arguments were replaced by compliance. When Randy was in his 30s, he sought therapy for a long-standing eating disorder. To his surprise, instead of discussing diet and exercise plans, the therapist had asked him about how he reacted to controlling people in his life. At first, Randy couldn't think of a controlling person. But after some consideration, he thought of Will. Will teasing Randy. Will humiliating Randy in front of friends. Will taking Randy for granted. Will taking advantage of Randy. Those memories were not simply intellectual pictures in Randy's mind. They carried hurt, anger, and resentment. They were the seeds of boundaries in Randy's life. People who can't get angry when they are being violated, manipulated, or controlled have a genuine handicap. No warning light alerts them to boundary problems. This light, when functioning properly, should turn on quickly when you are being attacked. The Bible describes anger in terms of heat. "Then the Lord's anger burned against Moses." Exodus 4:14. "Therefore the Lord's anger burned against this land." Deuteronomy 29:27. Anger is like a fire that shoots up within your heart, letting you know there's a problem to confront. Our inability to get angry is generally a sign that we are afraid of the separateness that comes with telling the truth. We fear that saying the truth about our unhappiness with someone will damage the relationship. But when we acknowledge that truth is always our friend, we often give ourselves permission to be angry. So before you say anything confrontive, even before you set that first boundary, examine your heart. Ask yourself, do I have permission to feel angry when I'm controlled by others? Am I aware when I'm being violated? Can I hear my early warning signal? If so, you're on the right track. If not, this is a good time to work on finding a safe place to tell the truth. As you are better able to be honest about differences and disagreements, you will be better able to allow your anger to help you. Step number 2. A change of tastes, becoming drawn to boundary lovers. It had been a full 12 months since Tammy and Scott had changed churches. They were reflecting back on the last year. They had attended their former church since their marriage several years ago. It was a doctrinally correct and active fellowship. But one problem that didn't go away was the church members' attitude toward attendance at church functions. They placed a great premium on being present at each and every gathering, from choir specials to nighttime services to weekly Bible studies. When Scott and Tammy had to miss meetings, conflicts arose. They recalled the night old friends from out of town came to visit them. Tammy had called Janice, her Bible study leader, to tell her they'd be missing that evening's meeting.
"I think there's a problem in commitment here, Tammy," Janice had replied. "If we really meant something to you, you'd be here. But you just go and do what you have to do."
Tammy was furious and hurt. Janice had shamed her for wanting to have a night off with her friends. It was this inability of her group to understand the word no that subsequently fueled the couple's move to another church. Now, a year later, she and Scott were pleased with their decision. Though their present fellowship was also conservative and active, stressing lots of involvement, they didn't become critical or judgmental when members needed time off for some reason or another.
"How's this for a contrast?" Scott said to Tammy. "I called Mark, our men's prayer breakfast leader, yesterday. I had just flown in on a red-eye flight from L.A. I told him I'd be shot if I went to the breakfast. What do you think he told me?"
"What are you doing on the phone with me?" he said. "Get yourself in bed and catch some Z's.
That sort of understanding makes me want to be there next time."
At one time, both Scott and Tammy thought their first church's attitude was correct. They weren't even aware that others could understand their no. Now, a year later, they couldn't conceive of returning to that situation. People with immature, limit-setting abilities often find themselves involved with boundary busters. These may be family members, colleagues, spouses, church members, or friends. The boundary confusion seems normal to them, so they aren't very aware of the destruction it causes for themselves and others. As boundary-injured individuals begin developing their own boundaries, however, a change occurs. They become attracted to people who can hear their no without being critical, without getting hurt, without personalizing it, without running over their boundaries in a manipulative or controlling fashion. People who will simply say, "Okay, we'll miss you. See you next time." The reason for this shift is hidden in the way we have been constructed by God. We were created free for one basic purpose, to love, to be meaningfully close to God and to others. "And over all these virtues put on love, which binds them all together in perfect unity." Colossians 3:14. This fundamental truth underscores the deepest parts of our hearts. And when we find relationships in which we have freedom to set limits, something wonderful happens. In addition to the freedom to say no, we find the freedom to say a wholehearted, unconflicted, gratitude-driven yes to others. We become attracted to boundary lovers because in them we find permission to be honest, authentic, loving individuals. To a boundary-injured person, people who can say a clear no sometimes seems curt and cold. But as the boundaries become more firm, curt and cold people change into caring, refreshingly honest people. We need to join with boundary lovers in deep, meaningful attachments. Boundaries can't develop in a vacuum. As we make connections involving asking for support and understanding with these people, God gives us, through them, the grace and power to do the hard work of limit setting. This drawing to boundaried individuals extends to God. Some people will begin finding out that the holy, just God about whom they read in the Old Testament isn't so bad or scary.
He just has very clear boundaries. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts, Isaiah 55:9. Step number 3, joining the family. As we find our tastes changing from boundary-muddied relationships to more clearly defined people, we begin developing close and meaningful connections with people who have clear boundaries. We begin either growing in boundaries in our present relationships or finding new attachments in which to invest, or both. This is a crucial phase in boundary development. Why is it so important to join the boundaried family? Mainly because, as with any spiritual discipline, boundaries can't be worked on in a vacuum. We need others with the same biblical values of limit-setting and responsibility to encourage us, practice with us, and stay with us. That's what Wayne discovered. Wayne couldn't believe the change. Over the past few months, he had become aware of his lack of boundaries at work. While other employees went home on time, he was frequently asked to stay later. He wanted to stand up to his boss and let him know that his work limits were going to become tighter and more realistic. But every time he approached his superior, his anxiety kept him tongue-tied and silent. Wayne despaired of ever developing mature work boundaries. About this time, he joined a support group at church. His relationships in the group deepened, and he began to trust the members. Finally, he was able to emotionally take them with him to work the day he sat down with his boss and worked out the overtime conflict. It was the safety and support of the group that gave Wayne the strength he needed to tell the truth at work. Jesus defined fellowship as two or three people gathered in his name, saying that he would be there in their midst, Matthew 18:20. It is this very combination of his spirit and the emotional memories of those who believe in us that helps us keep firm boundaries. Why? Because we know we have a spiritual and emotional home somewhere. No matter how caustic the criticism or how severe the rejection of the one we're in conflict with, we aren't alone. And that makes all the difference in the world in boundary setting. Step number 4, treasuring our treasures. After you feel safe being around people who believe that grace and truth are good, John 1:17, your values will start to change. You will begin to see that taking responsibility for yourself is healthy, and you will begin to understand that taking responsibility for other adults is destructive. When people are treated as objects for long enough, they see themselves as someone else's property. They don't value self-stewardship because they relate to themselves the same way that significant others have related to them. Many people are told over and over again that nurturing and maintaining their souls is selfish and wrong. After a while, they develop a deep conviction that this is true. And at that point, they place little value on taking care of the feelings, talents, thoughts, attitudes, behavior, body, and resources God entrusted to them. This principle is taught in Scripture. We love because He first loved us. 1 John 4:19. In other words, we learn to be loving because we are loved. Grace must come from the outside for us to be able to develop it inside. The opposite side of this truth is that we can't love when we aren't loved. And, taking the thinking further, we can't value or treasure our souls when they haven't been valued or treasured. This is a key principle. Our basic sense of ourselves, of what is real and true about us, comes from our significant primary relationships. That's why many people who were unloved in childhood can be inundated by caring people in their adult years, yet not be able to shake a deep sense of being worthless and unlovable, no matter how much people try to show them their lovability. Helen's father sexually abused her in her early years. She was terribly traumatized by the molestation, but tried to keep the secret and protect the family from being upset. By her teenage years, however, Helen inadvertently began to tell the truth about her family problem in nonverbal ways.
she became sexually promiscuous at a very early age. As an adult, Helen reflected in therapy on her tumultuous teen years.
I can't even remember the boys' faces. All I knew was that someone wanted something from me, and I felt it was my duty to give it to them, for no other reason than that they wanted it. I felt that I had no say-so in the matter.
Helen had not been treasured by one of the people who should have treasured and cherished her most. As a result, she did not treasure herself. She provided sexual services to just about anyone who requested them. She had no sense that her body and feelings were a pearl of great value, Matthew 13:46, given to her by God, which she was to protect and develop. When Christians begin to value getting well, recovering, and developing themselves into the image of God, all of which are different ways of saying the same thing, a shift occurs. They begin desiring a return on God's investment. Remember the parable of the talents in Matthew 25:14-30? Taking care of themselves becomes important. Steve walked up to me excitedly one day. As he wasn't given to emotional outbursts, I knew something important was going on. He showed me his Bible, where he had been reading 1 Corinthians 8:11. So this weak brother, for whom Christ died, is destroyed by your knowledge. Something is happening inside of me, he said. For years I felt guilty about reading that passage. I thought it was condemning me for leading weaker Christians into sin.
Well, it does say that, I replied. But you've noticed something else.
I have, said Steve. I'm seeing that I'm also a brother for whom Christ died. That means I need to be as careful and concerned about myself as I am about others. There's no difference between what God thinks of him and what God thinks of me. Steve had realized an important theological point. For years, Christians have been taught that protecting their spiritual and emotional property is selfish. Yet God is interested in people loving others. And you can't love others unless you have received love inside yourself. Have you had Steve's experience? Is getting help and learning self-protection and biblical boundaries important to you? If it isn't, it will be difficult, if not impossible, to go through the hard work of developing good limits. You may need to spend some time around people who have a mature understanding of healthy boundaries and learn from their modeling. This principle is illustrated when the psalmist says, "Above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life." Proverbs 4:23. When we watch over our hearts, the home of our treasures, we guard them. We are to value our treasures so much that we keep them protected. Whatever we don't value, we don't guard. The security around a bank is significantly tighter than that around a junkyard. Begin a list of your treasures, your time, money, feelings, and beliefs. How do you want others to treat them? How do you want others to not treat them? Step number 5. Practicing baby no's. The group was silent. After many sessions of considering the prospect, Shireen was about to set a limit with another group member for the first time in her life. Praying silently, the group waited to see if she could become a truth-teller. I had asked Shireen to mention to a group member one thing that had rubbed her the wrong way in the past few sessions. Though she was terrified, she agreed to try. At first, she said nothing, obviously gathering up courage. Then slowly, she turned to a woman sitting next to her and said,
"Carolyn, I don't know how to say this, but here goes. It bothers me when you always take the good chair at group."
Quickly, she ducked her head, waiting for the rebuttal. There was none. At least, not what Shireen had expected.
"I've been waiting for you to say something," Carolyn explained. "I knew you were acting distant toward me, but I didn't know why. It helps to know, and I feel closer to you now. You took a risk to confront me. Who knows? I may even arm wrestle you for the chair."
Does this sound trivial? It isn't. Given her family background of a mother who made her feel guilty for setting limits, and a father who had rage attacks when she dared disagree, Shireen was taking a genuine plunge. For her, boundaries were out of the question until her anxiety and depression wrenched her life out of control. That's why the best possible place for Shireen to begin her boundary work was in her therapy group. Growth in setting emotional boundaries must always be at a rate that takes into account your past injuries. Otherwise, you could fail massively before you have solid enough boundaries.
"This boundary teaching doesn't work," complained Frank in a therapy session.
"Why not?" I asked.
"Well, as soon as I understood that I don't set good limits with people, I called my father the same day and gave him what for. Can you believe what he did? He hung up on me."
"This is great, just great. Boundaries have made things worse for me instead of better." Frank is like the overeager child who is too impatient for training wheels on his new bicycle. It's only after several falls and skinned knees later that he begins to entertain the possibility that he skipped some steps in his training. Here's an idea to help you navigate this step. Ask your support group or your good friends if you could work on boundaries with them. They will show you their true value in their response to your truth-telling. Either they'll warmly cheer you on in being able to disagree with and confront them, or they'll resist you. Either way, you'll learn something. A good, supportive relationship cherishes the no of all parties involved. The members know that true intimacy is only built around the freedom to disagree. "He who conceals his hatred has lying lips," Proverbs 10:18. Begin practicing your no with people who will honor it and love you for it. Step number 6. Rejoicing in the guilty feelings. As strange as it may seem, a sign that you're becoming a boundaried person is often a sense of self-condemnation, a sense that you've transgressed some important rules in your limit setting. Many people experience intense, critical self-judgment when they begin telling the truth about what is and isn't their biblical responsibility. Why is that? Let's look at the answer in terms of slavery and freedom. Boundary-injured individuals are slaves. They struggle to make value-based decisions on their own, but they most often reflect the wishes of those around them. And even though they can be surrounded by supportive boundary lovers, they still experience trouble setting limits. The culprit here is a weak conscience, or an overactive and unbiblically harsh internal judge. Though we need our internal evaluator to help us know right from wrong, many people carry around an extremely self-critical and inaccurate conscience. They feel that they are transgressing when they aren't. Because of this overactive judge, the boundary-injured individual often has great difficulty setting limits. Questions such as, "Aren't you being too harsh?" and "How can you not attend the party? What a selfish thought," are raised. You can imagine the havoc when the struggler actually sets a limit or two, even a small one. The conscience moves into overdrive as its unrealistic demands are being disobeyed. This rebellion against honest boundaries is a threat to the parental control of the conscience. It attacks the soul with vigor, hoping to beat the person into submitting again to its untruthful do's and don'ts. In a funny way, then, activating the hostile conscience is a sign of spiritual growth, a signal that you may be protesting unbiblical restraints. If the conscience were silent and providing no how-could-you guilt-inducing messages, it might mean that you were remaining enslaved to the internal parent. That's why we encourage you to rejoice in the guilt. It means you are moving ahead. Step number 7. Practicing grown-up no's. Think for a minute about this question. Who is your number one boundary buster? Who is the foremost person in your life with whom it's difficult to set limits? More than one person may come to mind. This step deals with those extremely complicated, conflictual, frightening relationships. Straightening out these relationships is a major goal in becoming a boundaried person. The fact that this is the seventh, and not the second, step underscores the importance of making sure we've done our painstaking homework and practice before now. Setting important limits with significant people is the fruit of much work and maturing. It's important not to confuse our goals here. Often, Christians who have been boundary injured think that the objective is to set limits on those important areas and get life stabilized again. They may be living for the day when I can tell Mom no, or when I can set limits on my husband's drinking. While these sorts of confrontations are very important, Jesus spoke of them in Matthew 18:15-20, they aren't the ultimate target of learning boundaries. Our real target is maturity, the ability to love successfully and work successfully, the way God does. This is the goal of becoming more like Christ. Dear friends, now we are children of God, and what we will be has not yet been made known. But we know that when He appears, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. 1 John 3:2. Boundary setting is a large part of maturing. We can't really love until we have boundaries. Otherwise, we love out of compliance or guilt. And we can't really be productive at work without boundaries. Otherwise, we're so busy following others' agendas that we're double-minded and unstable. James 1:8. The goal is to have a character structure that has boundaries and that can set limits on self and others at the appropriate times. Having internal boundaries results in having boundaries in the world. For as he thinks within himself, so he is. Proverbs 23:7. Developing a well-defined, honest, and goal-oriented character structure produces this step. By this time, those frightening major no's have been prepared for over time, with lots of work and practice. Sometimes the large no will precipitate a crisis. Someone important to you will be angry, or hurt, or abusive. The truth will expose the divisions in relationships. The conflicts and disagreements already exist. Boundaries simply bring them out to the surface. Prayerfully make a list of your significant relationships. Now add to that what specific treasures are being violated in these relationships. What specific boundaries need to be set to protect these treasures. Step 8. Rejoicing in the absence of guilty feelings. Step number 6 involved understanding that your first steps into a boundaried existence will most likely be met by the harsh resistance of an overactive and weak conscience. With consistent work and good support, however, the guilt diminishes. We become more able to keep hold of the deep truths of the faith with a clear conscience. 1 Timothy 3:9. You can take this step now that you have shifted allegiance spiritually and emotionally. You have changed from listening to your internal parent to responding to the biblical values of love, responsibility, and forgiveness. And these values have been internalized in the heart by many, many relational experiences with people who understand these values. The heart has somewhere to go for self-evaluation besides a critical conscience. The heart rests in the emotional memories of loving, truthful people. Evelyn knew something was different inside when she confronted her husband on his critical tirades. "That's it, Paul," she said, without raising her voice. "If you're not using a civil voice with me in 10 seconds, I'll be spending the evening at my friend Nan's house. Make your choice, because I'm not bluffing." Paul, ready to launch another verbal attack, closed his mouth. He, too, sensed that Evelyn was serious this time. He sat down on the couch and waited for her next move. What surprised Evelyn was the absence of her self-recriminations after setting limits. Usually, she would say to herself, "You didn't give Paul enough chances," or, "You've just got to stop being so thin-skinned," or, But he works hard, and he's good with the kids. Her group had worked. Her practicing had paid off, and her conscience had begun growing up. Step number 9. Loving the boundaries of others. A client once asked me, "Is there any way I can set boundaries with my wife, but not have her set limits with me?" Though I admired his candor, the answer obviously was no. If we expect others to respect our boundaries, we need to respect theirs for several reasons. Loving others' boundaries confronts our selfishness and omnipotence. When we are concerned about protecting the treasures of others, we work against the self-centeredness that is part of our fallen nature. We become more other-centered. Loving others' boundaries increases our capacity to care about others. It isn't difficult to love the agreeable aspects of others. It's another story, however, when we encounter another's resistance, confrontation, or separateness. We may find ourselves in conflict, or not getting something we might want from the other. When we can love and respect the boundaries of others, we accomplish two things. First, we genuinely care for another person because we gain nothing by helping someone tell us no. It just helps him or her deprive us better. The second advantage in loving others' boundaries is that it teaches us empathy. It shows us that we need to treat others as we would like to be treated. The entire law is summed up in a single command, "Love your neighbor as yourself." Galatians 5:14. We should fight for the no of others just as we should fight for our own no, even if it costs us something. Step number 10. Freeing our no and our yes.
"I love you, Peter,"
said Sylvia to her boyfriend as they sat over dinner. It was an important moment. Peter had just proposed marriage to Sylvia, and she was attracted to him. They seemed to be compatible in so many ways. There was only one problem. They had only been dating a few weeks. Peter's impulsive proposal was pushing it a little for Sylvia's tastes.
"And though I love you," she continued, "I need more time for us to be together before we get engaged. So, because I can't say yes to you, I'm saying no."
Sylvia shows the fruit of maturing boundaries. She wasn't sure, so she said no. People with undeveloped limit-setting abilities do the opposite. They say yes when they are unsure. Then, when they have committed themselves to someone else's schedule, they realize that they don't want to be in that particular situation anymore. But by then, it's too late. I worked as a house parent in a children's home for a time. In our training for the job of living in the same cottage with several active adolescents, one experienced professional told us, "There are two ways you can start off with kids. First, you can say yes to everything. Then, when you start putting limits on them, they'll resent you and rebel. Or you can begin with clear and strict limits. After they get used to your style, you can loosen up a little. They'll love you forever." Obviously, the second method works better. Not only did it clarify my boundaries for the kids, it taught me to free up my own no. This principle is at the heart of this yardstick. Our no becomes as free as our yes. In other words, when you are as free to say no to a request as you are to say yes, you are well on the way to boundary maturity. There's no conflict, no second thoughts, no hesitation in using either word. Think for a second about the last time you were asked for something from someone. Perhaps it was for some of your time that you weren't sure you had to give. Suppose the person asking is not selfish, manipulative, or controlling. Reasonable people can make reasonable requests sometimes. So you were asked for something you weren't sure you had left over to give. You weren't sure you could do it with a cheerful heart, 2 Corinthians 9:7. What happened next is what this particular boundary yardstick is all about. You probably did one of two things. Since you were unsure, you said yes. Since you were unsure, you said no. Which is the more mature of these? In most cases, the second. Why? Because it's more responsible to give out of our resources than to promise that which we might not be able to deliver. Jesus said that we are to calculate the cost of our endeavors. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it?
For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him. Luke 14:28-30. Boundary-injured individuals make promises and then do one of two things. 1. They resentfully make good, or 2. They fail on the promise. Boundary-developed people, however, make good freely and gladly, or they don't promise at all. Following up on guilt-ridden or compliant responsibilities can be quite costly, painful, and inconvenient. The lesson you need to learn is not to promise too much before you have done your spiritual and emotional calculations. Step number 11. Mature boundaries. Value-driven goal setting. Ben placed his pen down on the desk and looked over at his wife, Jan, satisfied. They had just spent a day together reviewing the last year and planning for the next one. This annual tradition had been developed over the past several years. It was a way for them to feel that their lives had some direction, some purpose. Before they had begun setting goals together, life had been chaotic. Ben had been controlling and impulsive. They hadn't been able to save much money because of his spending habits. Though she was good with money, Jan had been compliant and non-confrontive. So the more Ben spent, the more she withdrew and busied herself outside the house in volunteer missions. Finally, after a great deal of boundary work with a marriage therapist, Jan began setting limits on Ben's out-of-control behavior. She became more honest, less blaming, and much less resentful. Ben, in his turn, began developing more of a sense of responsibility toward the family. He even felt more tender toward his wife, even after she nailed him to the wall several times about his irresponsibility. Ben smiled. "Honey," he said to her, "this last year has been a 180-degree change from the one before. We saved some money. We achieved some financial goals. We're more honest with each other. We like each other better. And you're not running off helping every committee in town who needs a volunteer." Jan responded,
"Well, I don't need to anymore. I've got what I want here with you, the kids, our church support group, and the ministries we work in. Tell you what, let's plan what we want to do with ourselves, with the Lord, with our money, and with our friends, and make next year even better."
Ben and Jan were reaping the fruit of years of work. Their maturing, boundary-setting abilities were paying off in all sorts of ways. After all, the ultimate goal of learning boundaries is to free us up to protect, nurture, and develop the lives God has given us stewardship over. Setting boundaries is mature, proactive, initiative-taking. It's being in control of our lives. Individuals with mature boundaries aren't frantic, in a hurry, or out of control. They have a direction in their lives, a steady moving toward their personal goals. They plan ahead. The reward for their wise boundaries is the joy of desires fulfilled in life. Their investments in the years God has given pay off for them. It's a lot like Paul reflected at the end of his life. "The time has come for my departure. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith." 2 Timothy 4:6-7. But does life interrupt the process of the person with mature boundaries? Won't there be trials, complications, and people wanting me on their track and not God's? Absolutely. The days truly are evil. There will be all sorts of resistances to our boundaries and goals. But the person with mature limits understands that, makes room for that, allows for that. And he or she knows that should it be needed, a no is waiting inside the heart, ready to use. Not for an attack, not to punish another, but to protect and develop the time, talents, and treasures that God has allocated to us during our 60 years on this planet. Psalm 90:10. Chapter 16, A Day in a Life with Boundaries. Remember Sherry from Chapter 1? She stumbled through the day in a haphazard, out-of-control fashion. Imagine now that Sherry has read this book. She's decided to restructure her life within the clear boundaries we've outlined.
Her day is now characterized by freedom, self-control, and intimacy. Let's take a peek in on her life with boundaries. 6 a.m. The alarm sounded. Sherry reached over and turned it off.
I'll bet I can do without this alarm, she thought to herself. I've been awake for 5 minutes already.
Getting 7 or 8 hours of sleep had long been a fantasy of Sherry's, one which she had always felt was unrealistic with a family. Yet it had begun to happen. The kids went to bed earlier now that she and Walt had begun setting better time limits with them. She and Walt even got a few minutes to relax together before bed. The sleep goal didn't come without its price, however. Like the other night when Sherry's mother had once again made her unexpected surprise visit, this time she showed up at a time when Sherry had to work on a science fair project with her son, Todd. It had been one of the hardest things Sherry ever had to say.
Mom, I want to visit with you, but this is really a bad time. I'm helping Todd finish up his solar system project, and he needs my full attention. You could come in and watch if you'd like, or I could call you tomorrow and plan a time for us to get together.
Sherry's mother hadn't reacted well. The martyr syndrome had kicked in full force.
It's just as I've always known, dear. Who'd want to spend time with a lonely old lady? Well, I'll just go home and be by myself, like every other night.
At one time, Sherry would have folded under such a masterful onslaught of the guilties. But Sherry had, after lots of practice with her support group, decided how to handle her mom's unexpected visits, and she didn't feel so guilty anymore. Mom would be fine the next morning, and Sherry would have a good evening. 6:45 a.m. Sherry slipped into her new dress. It fit perfectly, 2 sizes smaller than she had worn a few months ago. Thanks, God, for my new self-boundaries, she prayed. Her diet and exercise program had finally worked, not because she learned any new secrets about food and working out, but because she saw taking care of herself not as selfishness, but stewardship. She had stopped feeling guilty about taking the time away from other things to work on her body. Getting in shape made her a better wife, mom, and friend, and she liked herself better. 7:15 a.m. Amy and Todd were finished with breakfast and were taking their plates to the sink to rinse them and place them into the dishwasher. Sharing household tasks had become a comfortable habit for all members of the family. Sure, the kids and Walt had resisted, but then Sherry stopped preparing breakfast until she got help with cleaning up. A miracle had happened with the kids and Walt. A light had gone on inside saying, "If I don't work, I don't eat." Even more satisfying was watching the kids get to their school rides on time, with a couple of minutes to spare. Beds made, homework done, lunches packed. Incredible. Of course, the path to that place had been rocky. In the beginning, Sherry had called the carpool parents and told them to wait a maximum of 60 seconds for her kids, then leave for school. And they did. When Amy and Todd missed their ride, they had accused Sherry of betraying and humiliating them.
"You just don't care about our feelings."
Tough words for a loving mother trying to learn boundaries. Yet, with a fervent prayer life and a good support group, Sherry held to her boundaries. After a few days of having to walk and being several hours late to school, the kids had begun setting their own alarms. 7:30 a.m. Sherry put her makeup on in front of her dresser. She was still not used to this after all those years of applying eyeliner in the car's rearview mirror, but she enjoyed the peacefulness and left for work with a few minutes to spare. 8:45 a.m. Walking into the conference room of McAllister Enterprises, where she worked as a fashion consultant supervisor, the promotion had been for leadership effectiveness, Sherry glanced at her watch. The meeting was about to start, with herself as chairperson. Glancing around the room, she noted that 3 key people weren't here yet. She made a note to chat with those colleagues. Maybe they were having boundary problems she could assist them with. Sherry smiled. She remembered the days, not too long ago, when she would have been grateful for someone at work to help her with the same problems. "Thank you, God, for a church that teaches a biblical view of boundaries," she prayed, and began the meeting. On time. 11:59 a.m. Sherry's extension rang. She picked it up. "Sherry Phillips," she said, waiting for the answer.
"Sherry, thank goodness you're there. I don't know what I'd have done if you'd been at lunch."
There was no mistaking that voice. It belonged to Lois Thompson. It was unusual for Lois to call these days. She didn't call much at all since Sherry had begun addressing the imbalances in the relationship. She had confronted Lois over coffee.
"Lois, it seems as though you always want to talk to me when you're hurting. And that's fine, but when I'm struggling, you're either unavailable, distracted, or uninterested."
Lois had protested that this wasn't at all true.
"I'm a true friend, Sherry," she said. "I guess we'll find out. I need to know if our friendship is based on what I do for you or on true friendship, and I want you to be aware of some boundaries I'm setting with us. First, I won't always be able to drop everything for you, Lois. I love you, but I simply can't take that kind of responsibility for your pain. And second, there will be times when I'm really hurting, and I'm going to call you and ask for support. I actually don't know if you know me and my pain at all. So we both need to find out." Over the next few months, Sherry had found out a great deal about this friendship. She found out that when she couldn't console Lois during her chronic emergencies, Lois would withdraw, hurt. She found out that when Lois was doing all right, she would ignore Sherry. Lois never called just to see how Sherry was doing. And she found out that when Sherry herself called Lois with problems, Lois could only talk about herself. It was sad to find out that a childhood connection had never really flourished into a mutual attachment. Lois simply couldn't come out of her self-centeredness enough to want to understand Sherry's world. But back to the phone call. Sherry answered, "Lois, I'm glad you called, but I'm out the door. Can I call you back later?"
"But I need to talk to you now," came the sullen response.
"Lois, call back if you want to. Here are some better times."
They said their goodbyes and hung up. Maybe Lois would call back, maybe not. More likely, Lois's other friends were all busy, and Sherry's name had come up next on the call list.
"Well, I'm sad that Lois isn't happy with me," Sherry thought to herself. "But people probably weren't too happy with Jesus when he withdrew from them to be with his Father." Trying to take responsibility for Lois's feelings was trying to own something God never gave me. With that thought, she went to lunch.
4 p.m. Sherry's afternoon passed fairly uneventfully. She was on the way out of the office when her assistant, Jeff Moreland, flagged her down. Without stopping her pace, Sherry said to him,
"Hi, Jeff. Can you leave me a message? I need to be on the road in 30 seconds.
Frustrated, Jeff left to write the message. What a shift in the last few months. For Sherry's boss to be her assistant wasn't something she had expected. Yet, when she had begun setting limits in her job and not covering Jeff's bases for him, Jeff's productivity had dropped dramatically. Jeff's irresponsibility and lack of follow-through emerged. His own superiors had, for the first time, become aware that he was the problem. They had discovered that Sherry was the driving force behind the design department. She was the one who made things happen. While Jeff took credit for all the work, he let her do it while he talked to friends on the phone all day. Sherry's boundaries had done their job. They had exposed his irresponsibility. They had clarified where the actual hole in the wall was. And Jeff had begun changing. At first, he had been angry and hurt. He had threatened to leave. But finally, things had settled down a bit. And Jeff had actually begun being more punctual. He had buckled down. The demotion had woken him up, let him see that he'd been riding on the coattails of others. Sherry and Jeff still had their problems. He had a hard time hearing no from her. And it was difficult for Sherry to tolerate the resentment. But there was no way she'd trade problems with the Sherry who had had no boundaries. 4:30 p.m. The session with Todd's fourth-grade teacher went well. For one thing, Walt had attended with Sherry. Knowing he was supportive made a lot of difference, but more important, the hard boundary work that Sherry and Walt were doing at home with Todd was beginning to pay off.
"Mrs. Phillips," said the teacher, "I'll admit, I took Todd with some reservations after consulting with Mrs. Russell, his third-grade teacher. But there is a significant improvement in your son's ability to respond to limits.
Walt and Sherry smiled at each other. Believe me, Walt said, there was no magic formula. Todd hated doing homework, minding us, and taking responsibility for household chores, but consistent praise and consequences seemed to have helped. The teacher agreed.
They really have. Not that Todd's a compliant angel. He'll always speak his mind. And I think that's good in a child. But there's no major struggle in getting him to behave. It's been a good year so far. Thank you for your support as parents.
5:15 p.m. As Sherry fought the afternoon rush-hour traffic, she felt strangely grateful for it.
I can use this time to thank God for my family and friends, and plan a fun weekend for us.
6:30 p.m. Amy walked into the family room right on time.
"Mother-daughter time, Mom," she said. "Come on, outside."
Leaving the house, they started on their pre-dinner walk around the block. It mainly consisted of Sherry's listening to Amy chatter about school, books, and friends, all the things she had yearned to be able to discuss with her daughter. The walk was always too short. It hadn't always been like that. After a Christian therapist had seen Amy and the family about her withdrawal, he had noticed that Todd's misbehavior monopolized the family's attention. Amy wasn't a squeaky wheel, so she received less time with Sherry and Walt. Gradually, she had withdrawn into herself. There just wasn't anyone in the house to give her anything. Her world had become her bedroom. Noting the problem, Sherry and Walt had made special attempts to make sure Amy was encouraged to talk about her issues, even if they weren't the crises Todd was in. Over time, like a flower opening up to the light, Amy began interacting with her parents once again. She was beginning to connect like a normal little girl would. The boundary work that Sherry and Walt did with Todd was part of Amy's healing process, too. 7 p.m. Halfway through dinner, the phone rang. After the third ring, the answering machine screened a caller.
"Sherry, this is Phyllis from church. Can you pitch in for the retreat next month?"
The answering machine was the answer to dinner's disruptions. The family's boundary was no phone conversations until dinner is through, and the family time at the table was richer for it. Sherry made a mental note to call Phyllis later that evening and regretfully decline. She and Walt were having a couple's weekend during those days. It helped keep them honeymooning. Interestingly enough, when Sherry's boundary work had first begun, she had started backing off from church commitments to sort out her chaotic life. Now, however, she was sensing more of a desire to be involved in a couple of ministries to which she felt called. "It's like comforting as I've been comforted," she thought to herself. But she realized that she'd probably never be as available to Phyllis as Phyllis wanted. But that was between Phyllis and God. Sherry was out of that particular loop. 7:45 p.m. The kids and Walt cleared the table. They didn't want to miss the next night's dinner any more than they had breakfast. 9:30 p.m. The kids were in bed with their homework assignments done. They had even had some playtime before bed. Walt and Sherry sat down together with a cup of coffee. They talked quietly about each other's day. They laughed over the goof-ups, commiserated over the failures, planned the weekend, and talked about the kids. They looked into each other's eyes, glad the other one was there. A miracle of miracles, and a hard-won one. Sherry had had to go to therapy herself, along with joining a church support group. It had taken a long time to move out of her loving Walt out of his anger modality. Her boundaries had needed much practice with safe people before she was ready to confront her husband. And it had been a scary time. Walt hadn't known what to do with a wife who could set limits, who would say to him, "Just so you'll know in advance, it hurts me and distances me from you when you cruelly criticize me in public. If you continue, I'll confront you on it immediately, and I'll take a cab home. I won't live a lie anymore, and I will protect myself from now on." Here was a wife who would no longer take responsibility for Walt's tantrums and withdrawal, who would say, "If you won't talk to me about your unhappiness, I'll back off. I'll be with a couple of my friends if you want to talk." This was a difficult adjustment, for Walt was used to Sherry's drawing him out, soothing his ruffled feathers, and apologizing for being imperfect. Here was a wife who confronted his emotional distance with, "You are my first choice for intimacy. I love you, and want to make you first in my heart. But if you won't spend time being close, I'll spend that time in support groups, at church and with the kids. But I won't be in the den watching you watching TV anymore. You'll have to microwave your own popcorn from now on." He had threatened, he had sulked, he'd withdrawn, but Sherry stuck to her guns. With help from God, her friends, her therapist, and her church support group, she had withstood Walt's blusterings. He began to experience what it was like not to have her around and underfoot all the time. And he missed her. For the first time, Walt actually experienced his dependency on Sherry, how much he needed her, how much fun she was when she was around. He began to slowly, gradually fall in love with his wife again, this time a wife with boundaries. She changed, too. Sherry stopped playing the victim with Walt. She found herself blaming him less. She was less resentful. Her boundaries helped her develop a full life that didn't need Walt to be as perfect as she had wished. No, it wasn't an ideal marriage, but it felt more solid now, like an anchor in the storms. They were more like a team, with mutual love and mutual responsibility. They were not afraid of conflict. They forgave each other's mistakes and respected each other's boundaries. 10:15 p.m. Lying in bed, snuggled next to Walt, Sherry reflected over the past months of boundary work. She felt warm and grateful for the second chance God had given her. A passage of Scripture came to her mind, one which she had read many times and knew well. It was the words of Christ from the Sermon on the Mount. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth." Matthew 5:3-5. "I'll always be poor in spirit," she thought. "But my boundaries help me find the time to receive the kingdom of heaven. I'll always mourn the losses I suffer in this lifetime. But setting limits helps me find the comfort I need from God and others. I'll always be meek and gentle. But being a separate person helps me take the initiative to inherit the earth. Thanks, God. Thank you for the hope you gave me, and for taking me and those I love along your path."
You have been listening to Boundaries, When to Say Yes and When to Say No to Take Control of Your Life, by Dr. Henry Cloud and Dr. John Townsend. Read by Dick Fredericks. Produced and directed by Jeff Bowden for Zondervan New Media. Digital recording at Zondervan Studios, Grand Rapids, Michigan. Mixing and CD mastering by Jonathan Mensink at Zondervan Studios, Grand Rapids, Michigan. Recording copyright 2001 by Zondervan. This product contains the complete text of the book Boundaries, copyright 1993 by Henry Cloud and John Townsend, all rights reserved. Unauthorized duplication is prohibited by law. This unabridged Zondervan Audio Pages production is available in a printed book edition at your local bookstore.